Let's continue our review of capital budgeting techniques by talking about the cash flows associated with the project. First thing I'm going to do, I'm going to try to draw a cash flow timeline here. So let's say we have a cash flow timeline that looks something like this. In fact, let me extend it a little bit further here. And we have, let's make it easy and just say three cash flows. So this is period 0, 1, 2, and 3. And what we have in the current period is the cash flow is basically the cost of the project. Then we have the cash flow, we'll label it CF with a hat 1, indicating the hat indicates that it's an expected cash flow, CF hat 2, and CF hat 3. These cash flows can be divided into three categories. And I'll put that down at the bottom here, where I'll just call these a CF category. There's three different categories, as I mentioned. The categories include, first of all, what we refer to as the initial investment outlay. The initial investment outlay is pretty easy to identify. And I'm going to abbreviate here, but the initial investment outlay would be a cash flow that occurs as the result of the purchase of the asset. It's a one-time cash flow. In other words, it only occurs one time. And it occurs at the beginning of the life of the asset. So I'll just put beginning in here. What would be included in this cash flow would be things like the purchase price, shipping and installation, anything that is an upfront cost that is associated with buying and putting into service the particular asset. Then we have what we call supplemental operating cash flows. The supplemental operating cash flows are cash flows, and again I'm going to abbreviate here, these are cash flows that occur during the life of the project, and they continue. In other words, they continue for, I'll put in here, multiple years. Let me erase this and spell it correctly so that everything's not run together here. So these cash flows, the supplemental operating cash flows, occur during multiple years. And that, an example would be if there's an increase in sales as a result of putting a new project in service, or a decrease in expenses like utilities or salaries and so on. Those occur year after year after year. Then finally we have what we refer to as the terminal cash flow. The terminal cash flow occurs at the end of the, it's like the initial investment outlay. It's a one-time cash flow. So it occurs one time, but in this case, this is at the end of the life of the project. And examples of terminal cash flows would be the salvage value of the project, maybe the taxes on that salvage, and so forth. So if I identify these cash flows, just to make sure we're clear on where they fit, I'm going to put a little star in red by the initial investment outlay, and then I'm going to circle it up on my cash flow timeline. That's the cost. That's pretty simple. Then in blue, I'll put a little star down here next to the supplemental operating cash flows, because now what I'm going to do is basically circle these supplemental operating cash flows that occur over the life of the project. And I'm going to make a little modification to it in just a second, but it looks like these future cash flows that I have here. Then we'll come back, I don't know, let's pick an orange color, I guess, a little off red, and I'll put a star over here by the terminal cash flow. And here's what I've got to say. I've got to come down. Let me get my green color back again. This cash flow in year 3 actually consists of two different cash flows. And I'll use the colors that I have related next to the cash flow categories. It relates, first of all, one cash flow is the terminal, I'm sorry, I'll back up and do the supplemental operating cash flow first. One cash flow is the supplemental operating cash flow that is received at the in the very last year of the project. I'll just put a C hat F there, or CF hat, I should say, I'm sorry. Okay, and then the second cash flow, which we did in orange, would be the terminal cash flow. Oops, let me put my pen back together here. Is the terminal cash flow, which I guess I'll just put TCF here for terminal cash flow. Now what that means is in the last year, we actually, this the cash flow, the total cash flow that I'm calling CF hat subscript 3 consists of two different cash flows from a cash flow category. And that is one, which is the supplemental operating cash flow that might include increase in sales that result from the project or savings of salaries. And the second cash flow is the terminal cash flow, which results from salvage value or disposing of the asset at the end of its life. Okay, next what we'll do is a couple problems, then an explanation of those problems as we go through them related to the cash flows and adjusting projects' required rates of return for risk if those projects have different risk than the norm that the firm invests in. Okay, let's take a look at this problem, which actually is quite interesting, because what we're doing is talking about depreciation here. You can see on the screen it says that a firm's evaluating a new machine to replace an existing machine. And what we've got is two different depreciation levels. And let me write these down. So the old machine, I'll just call it old depreciation, and abbreviate here, is $25,000. The new depreciation is going to be higher. The new depreciation is going to be $30,000. Now, first of all, depreciation is a non-cash item, and I'll put that out here. This is non-cash. Depreciation does not require the firm to write a check in these amounts. However, depreciation is tax deductible, and because depreciation is tax deductible, it affects cash. In this case, a cash in the form of taxes. The question here is, if this new machine is purchased, what effect will depreciation, this change in depreciation, have on the firm's incremental operating cash flows? Well, here, first of all, we can just net these out, and you can see the change in depreciation is $5,000. It's going to increase by $5,000. Well, I can tell you what that means is the change in the cash flows associated with the depreciation will be equal to the change in depreciation, let me just abbreviate with DEP here, times the tax rate. In our example here, if we work this out, that'll be $5,000 times 0.4. And that works out to $2,000. So if I did my computations correctly, what that means is that if this firm purchases the new machine to replace the old machine, its cash flows, just because of depreciation, not because of anything else, but only because of depreciation, should increase by $2,000. And the reason is because it's going to save taxes in the amount of $2,000, basically. Let's see if that's the case. What I'm going to do is a simple example. I think I can get it in down here at the bottom. I'm going to say this is... we'll call it, let me get rid of this first of all. We'll call it NOI before depreciation, or I'll put without depreciation. Okay? And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to say it's $50,000. And I'm going to have this. I don't want to get too cramped in here, but I'm afraid I will. This is the old machine, or with the old machine, existing machine, and this will be with the new machine. So we'll assume, just for this example, that a net operating income doesn't change because we put on the new machine. The new machine is just going to keep things as they are. However, what's going to happen is the depreciation will be different for both machines. So the depreciation is currently $25,000. And what we're going to do is go down and compute what the taxes would be here. So that means that taxable income or operating income, the net operating income here, after depreciation, so I guess I can do this, I can say with depreciation, is $25,000 for the old machine, because the new machine has $30,000 as its depreciation. The new machine will have net operating income with depreciation, or depreciation included, of $20,000. Okay, now what we want to do is compute the taxes on this. I only want to look at the operating income after taxes. And the taxes here, I'll put in parentheses, are 40%. 40% of $25,000 is $10,000. And you can see in this case, this would be after tax. Let me just put AT for after tax NOI, net operating income. It's going to be $15,000. If we keep the old machine, there's going to be $8,000 in taxes for the new machine, 20,000 times 0.4, which will give me $12,000 for after-tax operating income with the new machine. Now, it looks like the new machine is not doing as well as the old because the after-tax operating income is lower. However, remember, and let me put this in red, we have an item here that is a non-cash item. That non-cash item is this line right here, depreciation. So what I need to do is add back to adjust for depreciation for that non-cash item. What I'm going to do down here is add back depreciation. So I'll add back $25,000 and add back $30,000. And you can see the result is I get $40,000 for the cash, and this would be, I'll call this operating cash flow. The operating cash flow with the existing or old machine, $40,000. Look, it's $42,000 for if the new machine replaces the old machine. And as you can see, that is a difference. The change here is in the cash flow is equal to $2,000. And that's the same as what we had up here. Now, I just made this example up with $50,000 as the net operating income. It doesn't matter. You could use $100,000. You could use $1,000,000. It doesn't matter as long as you use the $25,000 depreciation for the existing machine and the new machine's $30,000 depreciation and a 40% tax bracket. So you can see what happens here is that even though depreciation is a non-cash item, it affects cash in the form of taxes. And if you look at taxes, by the way, over here, you can see that the change in the taxes was $2,000. Exactly what we would have expected. All right, next what we'll do is an example of selling a machine at the end of its life and what the net cash flow that would be generated from that would be. Okay, here's an example of a company that plans to sell a machine that it has. In this case, it plans to sell the machine for $52,000. The machine has a book value of $45,000. Really, the question is, there's a couple of questions, but bottom line is, what is the net cash flow that the firm will receive from selling this machine? Let's label this information. First of all, let me turn the pen to a different color here. First of all, the selling price is the $52,000. I'm not going to use dollar signs, so $52,000. The book value, I'm just going to abbreviate BV here, is $45,000. So using this information, the first thing I'll do is compute whether there's a gain or a loss on this, or I really should say the gain, whether it's positive or negative. The gain is equal to the selling price, in this case $52,000, minus the book value, which is $45,000. So the gain on the sale of this particular machine, this thing called a lathe, is $7,000. Now remember, what the IRS basically says here is that the firm, if depreciation worked perfectly, the book value and the selling price should be exactly the same. But it doesn't, and we know that. The IRS knows that. And in this case, what the IRS is saying is the firm wrote off $7,000 too much, so there's taxes on the sale of this particular machine. And what the IRS is basically saying is to the firm, you have to give back the tax savings that you had over the years by using depreciation, and by depreciating too much. In this case, by depreciating $7,000 too much. And as you can see, all I need to do is take the gain of $7,000 and multiply times the tax rate of 40%. So what that means is the firm's going to have to pay $2,800 in taxes when it sells this machine. So let's go back to answer the question that was originally posed. First of all, the cash flow from the sale is going to be $52,000 because the firm is going to sell this machine for $52,000, whether it's sold to a junkyard, to another company, or whatever, that's a cash inflow. However, the firm's going to have to pay taxes. So the tax on the sale, as we just computed, is going to be $2,800, and that's a negative. And when we net these two out, this is going to be the net cash flow from the sale of the asset. In this case, this should be $49,200. So effectively, the amount that the firm can walk away with after the payment of after selling the machine and paying taxes is $49,200. And that would be the answer to the original question, which was, what is the net cash flow that the firm will generate by selling this particular asset? Now let's take a look at how we evaluate projects that have different levels of risk than the firm's average project or existing. The firm currently has a portfolio or a combination of machines and buildings, etc., which are all of its assets. And there's an average risk to the existing assets. So when a firm evaluates new assets, it should compare the riskiness of the new asset or the proposed asset with the existing assets that the firm has. And if the proposed capital budgeting project is much riskier than the existing assets of the firm, we should adjust the rate of return that is used to evaluate the project. If that particular project has much less risk than average, then we should adjust it downward. So according to this problem, this particular company has a required rate of return. Now let's write it up here so that we can see it in front of us. The required rate of return of this firm is 11%. Now that 11% is based on the average risk of the existing projects. So that basically is the rate that is associated with the norm of the firm, I guess we can say it. Now what it says here is the firm adds 4 percentage points to that average rate if the project has high risk. So I'll put that up at the top too, even though we're going to adjust these down below. What we're doing is saying this. I'll put R with a subscript H for high risk. What we're going to do is take the 11% and add 4 to it. So that means the rate of return that should be used for high risk projects is 15%. The problem also says if the project has a substantially lower risk, then we're going to take the 11% and adjust it downward by 2 percentage points, which means that the appropriate rate of return should be 9%. Now the question, of course, is of the projects that are listed in the table below, which should be accepted? And by the way, I should come over here and say, when we say expected rate of return here, this is IRR. So I'll just put in here, that's the IRR. What I'm going to do over here is, in the far right column, I'm going to put in here what I'm going to call risk-adjusted return, or risk-adjusted, actually, R. And that's exactly what we have up above. Let me extend this line so that we have a line going all the way across. All right, and we're going to do that based on risk. So Project A has high risk, and the rate of return, according to what I have above, should be 15%. Project B has average risk, so that should be evaluated at 11%. Project C has high risk, 15%. Low risk for Project D, that should be evaluated at 9%. Then average risk is 11 and low risk is 9. So now what we need to do is compare the risk-adjusted rate of return and the expected rate of return or internal rate of return to make a decision as to whether the project should be accepted or not. And I'm just going to put a Y or an N. Well, look, in this case for Project A, the internal rate of return is 12%. And that project, because it's high risk, should earn at least 15%. So the answer is no, that is not acceptable. Project B has 10.5%. It should be earning 11%. The answer is no, that's not acceptable. In other words, here's what we're saying. Let me label it down here at the bottom. IRR is in this column, and the numbers in this column have to be greater than the numbers in this column to be acceptable. In the first two, that's not the case. Now look at Project C, though. Project C has a 16% IRR, and the appropriate rate of return is 15%, so that is acceptable because the rate of return is higher. Project D also, look, 10% is the rate of return on the project, and we only require on low-risk projects a 9% return, so that is an acceptable project. Project E, if we continue, is acceptable as well because it's an average risk project yielding 12.5% when the firm's average rate is 11%. And finally, Project F, 6.5, but we need to get 9%, so it is not acceptable. So you can see now what the adjustment needs to be made to account for different levels of risk. Now, in reality, firms actually just go through and they do some analyses to make the determination, for example, in this firm, that 4 percentage points should be added to riskier projects, added to the average rate of return, and 2% reduced for substantially low-risk projects. Think about what would happen if that adjustment was not made. And I'll do this in a different color, and we'll do it over here. I'll just do it in between here and say, okay, if I compare the expected rate of return for Project A to, and I'm just going to compare, I'll circle it up here, to the 11%, so I don't make any adjustment. I would say, yes, that project's acceptable. No, that project is not. Yes, no. In other words, everything that is above 11% is acceptable. Anything below 11% is not acceptable if I use the average required rate of return without any adjustment. Now take a look and see what the differences are. I made different decisions for, and I'll circle them over here. I said no after adjustment. I said no, so this one is okay. That's the same. This is the same. This is not the same. I said yes after the adjustment, and no without the adjustment. This is the same, and this is the same. I would have made two errors without making the adjustment. If you look at the errors that I would have made, I would have, this is a high-risk project here, Project A. I would have actually accepted that project when in reality the correct answer is over here. I should have not accepted. I should have rejected the project. And at the same time, down below here, the error that I would have made with a low-risk project, I would have rejected a 10% rate of return when the real rate of return I should have been using was 9%. So I would have made two errors. I would have accepted a project that was too risky and was not earning a high enough rate of return, and I would have rejected a project that didn't have very much risk or was substantially lower risk that earned a high enough return for the level of risk that it had, but it wasn't high as the firm's average rate of return. So hopefully this shows you the adjustments that should be made to take into consideration riskiness when projects that we're evaluating are either substantially higher in risk or have substantially lower risk.